Just last night, I was having a look at the news, and I was reading an article that was saying that they've newly discovered some tombs of Egyptian pharaohs in Egypt, and they're all, you know, archaeologists are really excited by this. And that got me thinking, when you are an archaeologist, when you go to an Egyptian tomb, you may find some interest in the architecture, you may find some interest in the walls and the passageways and the way that the tomb is designed, but the reason you're there, the real reason, particularly if any of you have seen Indiana Jones, is you want to get to the treasure that's at the heart of the tomb. That's what you really want, the gold, the silver, the jewels, the sarcophagus, all inlaid with precious metals and so on. And that, in turn, had me thinking about today. Because when we get to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, what we are reaching is the heart of what Paul was wanting to say to this church. That's not to say that chapter 1 is irrelevant. It is still helpful for us. It is still useful for us to read and to reflect on. But that really was Paul just sort of building the walls and laying the foundation for what he really wanted to say to them. You may remember from last week that there was some kind of false teaching that had arisen in the Thessalonian church. Paul had written to them first of all, but events had happened and he felt compelled to write to them again. And so we get today to the reason that he was writing to them, particularly to challenge this teaching that had come to the church and to explain to this to them. And so at the heart of Paul's second letter to the Thessalonians, we first read of an encouragement that the church are not to become unsettled or alarmed by this false teaching, despite the fact that some are saying, well, this is from the Apostle Paul. Now, if the Thessalonian church had taken time to reflect on that teaching before becoming agitated and worried, they would have realized that actually what they were being told was completely inconsistent with the teaching of the apostle. But I will say more about that in a moment as we work our way through this letter. Indeed, I almost read this letter and can imagine Paul kind of almost head in hands, frustratedly thinking, did you not heed my advice in the first letter? Because in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, Paul wrote, do not treat prophecies with contempt, but test them all. Thessalonians hadn't tested this teaching. They hadn't tested this prophecy that claimed that Jesus had already returned. Instead, they got panicked and contacted Paul and said, what's this all about? And Paul had to write to them a second time. And so there is the false teaching. This claim, Jesus has already returned. And so the Thessalonian church are worried, well, if Jesus has returned, why has nothing changed? We're still being persecuted. Did we miss it? Have we not been faithful enough? What's going on? And you may wonder, is it possible for a church, a whole church, to be duped into thinking that Jesus has already come back? Well, to defend the Thessalonians, there are two things that I would say. The first is that in the early church, the expectation was that Jesus' return was imminent, as in it would happen within a few decades of his ascension into heaven. And so there was this sense in the early church that they were simply just biding their time, only for a short period before Jesus would come back. He would finally put an end to the sinfulness of the world, and then all would be well in the new creation. The fact that we are here today is obviously a sign that Jesus has not yet come back, and there's an important couple of reasons for that. First of all, there's the reason that if Jesus had returned within a few decades of his ascension, then there would have been huge, huge parts of our world untouched by the gospel. And so there was a sense that God has had to wait to allow the gospel to spread across our world. The second caveat, I suppose you could call it, to this idea of Jesus' return being imminent is that our perception of imminent and God's perception of imminent are radically different. Indeed, in one of the Psalms, we read that to God, a thousand years is like a day, and a day is like a thousand years. God's concept and experience and understanding of time is totally different from ours, given that he created time. And so when something is imminent according to God's plan, that doesn't necessarily mean imminent in terms of our experience of that. So while Christ's return is indeed imminent, it was not quite as imminent as the early church expected. The second reason that the church may have been able to be convinced of this, that Jesus had already returned and they'd missed it, is because actually, even Jesus' resurrection was a surprise. The Jews believed in the resurrection. It was a belief that permeated the people of God from the moment that God called them to be his people. The belief that one day, at the end of time, all who are faithful to God would rise into a new world that God had redeemed and restored. What nobody expected, what nobody had anticipated, was that there would be one resurrection in the middle of time. In the middle of human history, there would be one who would rise again. Now, we, as Christians looking back, can understand that Jesus' resurrection was a necessary sign and seal of the promise of new life to us all. We know, in hindsight, that it was completely necessary. But they say, what, hindsight is 20/20 vision? It's easy to look back and make sense of things. It's much harder to look forward to see them coming. And so it was that the people of God had not necessarily anticipated the resurrection, although it's the understanding of its significance came later. But we need to appreciate that for the early church, this was new and uncharted territory. Nobody had been expecting there to be a resurrection in the middle of human history, let alone that that resurrection was fundamental to God's salvation of the human race. So this is new for them. This is unknown. They're kind of feeling their way forward in the dark, as it were. And so with that unexpectedness, it's perfectly possible that misunderstandings and false teachings would arise as people try to figure this out. Although I suspect that the false teaching about Jesus having already come back was not someone trying to figure it out, but just someone being bit of a pest, actually, to this church. Again, I feel that Paul, in writing this letter, is perhaps heavy-hearted, is a bit disappointed. I mean, he writes to this church so lovingly, with such affection. But remember, Paul was a real man who had real emotions. In 1 Thessalonians, again, in his first letter to this church, he made it clear to the Thessalonians that when Jesus comes back, you'll know. He writes, "For the Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud command." Chapter 5, verse 16. Paul had made it clear to this church, when Jesus comes back, you'll know. You'll know. But in any case, they had gotten themselves worked up, so Paul had to write to them and told them, don't become anxious, don't become alarmed or unsettled, because this is false teaching. It's not what I told you in my first letter. Anything subsequent to that, it doesn't fit with what I have told you, therefore it is not from me. And a response to false teaching, as I think is implied in Paul's letter, is as helpful for us today as it was then, and that is to beware and be aware. Be aware that false teaching exists, and it still does today. There are numerous attempts to preach false gospels in our world. How are we aware of it? Well, the way to be aware is to know the truth. It's why it's important for us to read our Bibles and pray every day. Primarily because that helps deepen our relationship with God, but also it has the knock-on effect that when we hear things that are masquerading as the truth, we recognize it because we say, well, that doesn't fit with the things I've read in the Bible. That doesn't fit with the things that I know to be true according to God's word. And so that awareness means we can avoid false teaching. Be aware of false teaching. Secondly, beware it. Because false teaching doesn't happen in a vacuum. It comes through people. And there are charlatans who stand at the front of church buildings Sunday by Sunday and spout a false gospel. Beware of those people. Because they are causing untold damage in people's lives. It's actually one of the few occasions where, personally, I would encourage someone to leave the fellowship of a church. There are not many reasons why I would encourage someone to leave a church fellowship, but that's one of them. Is the person Sunday by Sunday spouting a false gospel? And if the answer is yes, then all you are doing is putting yourself in a place where you're being told lies and damage is being done to your faith and your relationship with God. Beware the false teachers. Beware the charlatans. Again, the way to identify them is to listen to what they say and compare it with your own knowledge of the truth. One of the biggest and most destructive false gospels is the prosperity gospel. If you have faith in God, you will have lots of money, you'll have perfect health, and you'll live a great life. And if you don't have those three things, then your faith isn't strong enough. I would love to meet someone that preaches that and say, can you show me the bit in the Bible where God or Jesus or someone else actually says that that is the case? I'll wait. Because it's not there. And the reason I know it's not there is because I read my Bible and I pray. And it's why we need to do the same. Beware and be aware of false teaching. But ultimately, as Paul says to the church in 2 Thessalonians, do not become alarmed or unsettled. It is a reality. It is something that goes on. We test these things against the truth, but don't let it be a source of anxiety for you. Because let's face it, we've got enough to worry about. As an aside, in the letter that James writes in the New Testament, he talks about those who are teachers, and he says, you who are teachers shall be held to a higher standard on the day of judgment. That's a paraphrase, but that's roughly what he says. That's why I don't think that we need to worry about these false teachers. Certainly anyone that has been impacted by false teaching, we need to pastorally support them as they heal. But when it comes to the false teacher themselves, they will stand before God one day, and boy, will he hold them to account and say, how dare you abuse the privilege of ministry by spouting such nonsense in my name? So we have to be aware and beware. Paul goes on to explain to the Thessalonian church that part of the way that he knows that Jesus has not yet returned is because there are certain events that need to take place. There's an order to things. And he talks about this man of lawlessness, and he explains how this man of lawlessness will manifest and the things that will happen as a result of him. And he almost explains that that is a prelude to the return of Christ. And the question that I suppose we're all probably wondering is, well, who is he? Who is this man of lawlessness, and how do we keep watch for him? Well, the short answer is we have absolutely no idea. But I'll give you a slightly longer answer as well. This figure bears some resemblance to someone that we've met recently. And I hope that as you were hearing this read this morning, you were thinking, this sounds an awful lot like the language that was used in Daniel. And that's because it is. We met in Daniel chapter 7 and onwards a king who was described as one who exalted himself above all others, even God. He put himself in a place that was above all others. And we understand that that was a reference to one of the tyrants who conquered Jerusalem, Antiochus Epiphanes, who came and desolated the temple. Now, I didn't realize this at the time when we were going through Daniel 7. I only found it out as I was preparing for today that Antiochus was his name. Epiphanes was the title that he gave himself, and translated into English, it means God manifest. What an arrogant human being that was, to assign himself the name, I am God manifest. Just makes him even less likable, in my opinion. That image of the one who exalts himself above all others was then picked up by Jesus in Mark chapter 13. And he talked about the one who would come and bring desolation to the temple. And there are some who suggest that this is Jesus talking about the destruction of the temple by the Roman Empire in AD 70. But it is also likely that Jesus, as Paul does here, had a much longer view in mind and was connecting this to God's coming judgment. Which brings us to Paul, where he sets this man of lawlessness firmly in the context of God's final judgment. And while that's all important for us to note, it doesn't help us identify who this character is. It can't be Antiochus, because that was several thousand years ago. Can't be the Roman Empire, that was several hundred years ago, so who is this man of lawlessness? A couple of quotes for you from the commentaries that I read. Though it seems best to assume that the man of lawlessness is still to be revealed, in other words, it's a future event, the specifics of how that might look will likely surprise even the best of interpreters. Only in hindsight will we understand the full intent of the prophetic word. And I'm afraid that's the best answer I can give you today. Just as the people of God didn't anticipate the implications of Jesus' resurrection, and we can only understand it in hindsight, so it is with this prophetic word from Paul. People have tried to guess who this man of lawlessness is. Everyone from Adolf Hitler to the Pope to Barack Obama to Donald Trump all have been assigned this title. That's the one. That's the man of lawlessness. And then the next thing that will happen is that Jesus will come back. Well, until Jesus returns, we probably won't know. But when he does, it will then become obvious who this man of lawlessness was. It's also implied that Paul perhaps offered the Thessalonians more teaching than we have available, because in verse 5 of the reading he says, "Don't you remember that when I was with you, I used to tell you these things?" Clearly, the original audience knew more of Paul's teaching than we presently have. Therefore, Paul often speaks in abbreviated ways about matters that we probably wish he'd written about in greater detail. That's something that I think we just have to accept as we pass by this man of lawlessness. We just don't know. But there are two things about which we can be certain, and I want to make them abundantly clear right now. First of all, this man of lawlessness, this figure, in verse 3, we are told he is doomed to destruction. And then in verse 8, that the Lord Jesus will overthrow him with the breath of his mouth, destroy him by the splendor of his coming. And Paul wants the Thessalonians, and he wants us, to be under no illusions that evil cannot win. That if this man of lawlessness, whoever he is the manifestation of all that goes against God and what God wants, he cannot win. He may have a time of freedom to do as he wishes, but ultimately he cannot win. For Jesus defeated the power of sin upon the cross. He defeated the power of death upon his resurrection, and he will finally defeat the power of evil upon his return. God has been beating back the forces of evil through Christ, and he will win. There's a picture that I sometimes see online of the devil on one side and Jesus on the other, and they're locked in an arm wrestle. And I have a big problem with that image, because it implies that it could go either way. Well, it can't. It can only go one way. And that's the way of Jesus winning. So do not be afraid. Whenever we work out who this man of lawlessness is, don't be anxious, don't be frightened, don't be worried. Remember, Jesus has won. And even although evil has a time of freedom in our world just now to do as it pleases, upon the return of Christ, it's over. They're defeated. They're done. Thanks be to God for that. Paul then ends this section by reinforcing a point that he made in the first chapter. He speaks about those who do not love the truth or believe the truth will perish. And this is not God being maniacal or being unfair. This is God being just. Because as we said last week, God is fair. God presents humanity with a gospel choice. He says you can either accept me and believe that I have dealt with your sin through Christ, that I have taken away the power of death for you, that I have granted you a place in the new creation, or you can reject it. You can say, I want none of this. Ruth and I were talking last night, as we often do, and she was sharing with me something that she'd heard as part of her street pastor's training, and she said, atheism is ultimately about control. And she's right. Because if you're an atheist, then there is only one person that is in control, and that's you. Whereas Christianity invites us to give control over to God. It's why there's a humility in coming to God and saying, I need you. It's why there is a certain sense of us accepting that we are sinful, that we need help, and giving this over to God. Of course, what the atheist who is all about me doesn't realize is that although initially there is that requirement of humility, actually what we receive in return is so much better than what we get by just doing it our own way. Because we get assurance that there is one who loves us unconditionally and completely. We get assurance that there is one who is willing to forgive even the most heinous thing that we have done. We are given assurance that there is one who welcomes us into a family, an eternal family, where we are adopted children and he is our Father in heaven. We are given assurance that our lives are not meaningless, that there is purpose to what we do because we live for God sharing his gospel. We receive this promise that even although people can hurt us and steal from us and do all kinds of horrendous damage to us, they can never take from us the place that we have in the new creation in God's kingdom. So when Paul talks here about those who reject the truth being doomed to perish, what he is reminding the Thessalonians is of this gospel choice. The choice of God or the choice of ourselves. And that gospel choice challenges us today in two ways. The first is it invites you and me to ask the question sincerely, well, what have I chosen? Have I chosen God? And do I have access, therefore, through faith to all of those wonderful things? Or am I still stuck in a place of saying, I want to do it my way, and rejecting God? But the other challenge is also about how we present the gospel. Because if we have accepted God, if we have put our faith in him, if we have received all those wonderful promises and taken them as our own, then we have a responsibility to go and to give those choices to other people. And the thing I've written in my notes here is, are you working with God to present the gospel through your words and deeds? Or is God having to work in spite of you? Are you working with God, or is he having to work in spite of you? And we can take it back to being aware and bewaring the false teachers. God is having to work in spite of them, because they're presenting something that's false. And so God, through his Spirit, has to almost work around them to make sure that the people that are being indoctrinated with this false gospel at some point hear the true gospel message. And so there's that challenge for us. What is God doing with me? Is he working through me? Am I being a willing participant in sharing the gospel, or am I one of those people that God is having to work around? That is the gospel choice. And finally, Paul concludes this section with an encouragement for the Thessalonian church to stand firm, to hold fast to what they are doing, and to hold to the teaching that he has given them. This is despite the persecution they face and despite the false teaching which threatens to cause upset and confusion. And their holding fast is twofold. Again, it relates to something in 1 Thessalonians 1 where Paul talked about how their stand for their faith was evidence that they had been saved. Now, that doesn't mean that by standing up for the gospel, they are in any way increasing their position with God. Simply what Paul is saying is the fact that you're standing up is evidence of the reality of your faith. And it is your faith alone which allows you to come into God's presence. So when they are standing firm and holding fast for the gospel, it acts as evidence for the rest of the world that their faith is true. And it means that Paul can write in confidence that their faith is true because of the outward signs that they are showing. The second reason that they are holding fast is important is because it in itself has the potential to spread the gospel. And the image that came to my mind as I wrote this last section, when you go into a jeweler's and you say, I'd like to see that ring or that diamond or whatever, they bring it out and they show it to you and they put it on a black cloth. And the reason that they put the jewelry on a black cloth is because the dark background causes the jewel to look all the more radiant. Yes, it's a bit of a ploy, because it could be a dead cheap ring, and because it's on a black background, it looks the part. But that's what it means for us to stand firm in the gospel. We are the diamonds that stand out against the darkness of our world when we take a stand for God. And because we stand out, other people take notice. Other people see what we do, and they think, that's different. That doesn't just blend in with the rest of the darkness and the horror of our world. That actually stands out as something different. And I'm a firm believer that if people see that, God can use that to bring a spark of interest. I want to know more. I want to find out what that's all about. And God willing, as he works through them and hopefully works through us, that can grow into a faith that brings a person in from the dark, and then they shine out to the world, and the process continues. And that is why it's important to stand firm and hold fast. And so Paul has called this church to patient vigilance. We are to be vigilant against any kind of teaching that will lead us away from God's truth. We are to be vigilant in sharing the gospel, hoping that God will use us to bring others to faith in him. We are to be vigilant in holding to God's truth in our own lives and church, that at the very least we will stand out to our world as doing things the right, better, and true way, that is God's way. And we are to be patient. We are to do all of this until the time of Christ's return. We do not know when this will be, but we know it will happen at the right time, the time of God's choosing. We look forward to that day in hope, and until it arrives, we continue in our patient vigilance. Amen, and thanks be to God for his word to us today. We now take a break from 2 Thessalonians. Next Sunday, believe it or not, is the first Sunday of Advent. But we will return to the final chapter of 2 Thessalonians at the end of the year to hear the message about ending well.